Trevilian Next is a division of Trevilian, a financial services specialist search and talent advisory firm. Since inception, the Trevilian team has dedicated itself to enhancing the return on investment of a company's most important resource, its people.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Love, head of banking and fintech at Trevilian. Nice to see everyone. Welcome to another episode of Trevilian Next. Today, we are joined by our old friend, CK Lee, who is the president and COO at Interbank, which is a bank that is based in Oklahoma, but services both Oklahoma and Texas. CK is coming to us live from Fort Worth. How are you, CK?
Doing well, Brian. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks for coming on. I know that you go way back with Trevilian. I've probably known you for a decade plus. I started to get to know you when you were at Piper Sandler, and you just celebrated your 3-year anniversary at Interbank. So the first question I wanted to ask you was, coming from Wall Street, going to Main Street, what is that transition like? Were there some things along the way that were a little bit rude awakenings, or was it easy?
That's a good question, Brian. You know, it's been a fantastic experience. And the thing that I love is that, you know, whereas I used to have to worry, you know, wake up in the morning and worry about every bank in the market, now I just kind of have to worry about one bank. And I went from having a number of clients that were competing for attention, and now I have just one. One of the things that I love most about my investment banking career was, you know, the familiarity that you get with your clients. You know, when you sit with them through the 9 months to a year to sometimes 2 years it takes to gestate a transaction, you know, whether it's capital raising or M&A, you really get to know these clients very well, and you understand their balance sheets, you get a sense for the board dynamics, and you develop a tremendous affinity for, you know, the management teams, and you really have this sort of team framework, and it's a ton of fun, and then the deal closes, and it all just disappears, and you have to go make new friends, and you have to go find new deals, and so, you know, it has been wonderful over the last 3 years to really embed with a great group of people who are very good at what they do and really learn about them and understand their operating philosophy and dig in and know that, you know, I'm not looking at a deadline at some point where it all goes puff and, you know, I have to go find a new deal. So that part of it has been fantastic. And, you know, I think there are other distinctions that I've picked up along the way, you know, as I've transitioned into this line of work. And, you know, one of my big aha moments was, you know, 4, 5, 6 months after I got to the bank, we were really struggling over a credit. And I felt like every time it was sort of like whack-a-mole, every time we solved one problem, two more popped up. And I was having a conversation with our owner and I said, I just feel like maybe I'm trying too hard to get this deal done. In our bank. And he had to remind me, and it was a great lesson that, you know, he said, CK, this is not a commission business. You know, you have to get these deals right. And the closing is just the beginning of the process when it comes to, you know, administering and ultimately collecting on a loan relationship. And so, you know, I think that's been one of the more interesting lessons that I've had to learn is just learning about credit and learning about sometimes the best answer for a bank can be no. And, you know, for an investment banker, no's just not in our vocabulary, Brian. We always want to find a way to say yes. We always want to advocate for the deal because if it doesn't close, we don't get paid. And it's been, you know, an interesting process to kind of go through the transition at a bank that sometimes, you know, you do have to say no. And sometimes your best financial alternative is to not close the deal and, you know, to move on and go find something that fits better in our company. So, you know, it's been a great transition. I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, I've really been helped immensely by the folks that I get to work with every day.
But let's talk a little bit more about your bank, because looking at your balance sheet, looking at some of the metrics, and then in our conversation a few weeks ago, you know, it's kind of like mind blown knowing that your bank, all of the loans there are adjustable rate loans.
Right.
Your owner has just never believed in a fixed rate, you know, the thought process around that. So
right.
Tell me a little bit more about that. And also, maybe we dovetail that into talent as well, because when you bring on new lenders, that may be hard for them to wrap their heads around.
Yeah. No, and it's definitely a learning process. It was a learning process for me. You know, I kind of was brought up, you know, dealing with clients, and the clients were all steeped in modern risk management theory, which is you just hedge away any potential upside or downside, you know, and you diversify away, you know, anything you can. And, you know, I think, you know, the vast majority of banks in America obviously have figured out a way to blend their portfolios with fixed rate and adjustable rate. You know, just to give you some flavor for who we are, we're about $4.2 billion in assets as it sits today, about loan portfolio that's around, you know, $3.6, $3.7 billion. And about 95% of that, to your point, is adjustable rate loans floating tied to prime or SOFR, as the case may be. We, you know, we had some legacy LIBOR loans that have kind of, you know, transitioned to the new benchmark. But, you know, we try to really keep that posture to not necessarily erase interest rate risk, because you always have it, but just to erase any effects that human error on our part could cause to, you know, hamper our ability to capture margin. And so, you know, so we are subject to, you know, what the Fed does, obviously. And you know, naturally, when, you know, the last 10 or 15 years, we've had what we think is an artificially low interest rate environment. And it's not to say that there weren't pressures along the way to throw in the towel and try to figure out how to make money in that environment, but we just stayed consistent with the adjustable rate portfolio. And, you know, obviously, you know, as interest rate policies changed here over the last 12 or 18 months, you know, we've really benefited at our bank from that. You know, the 525 point or so reset in interest rates up, you know, really kind of blew through the top of all of our income models. And, you know, as our owners likes to say, we had our third best year ever in the first 6 months of 2023. And so it's kind of been an interesting, you know, situation to sort of observe, and to observe the way our portfolios responded to that and the way our borrowers have responded to it, quite frankly. And, you know, it's allowed us to really enjoy unprecedented margin expansion as we've kind of watched the cycle mature here.
Yeah. And I had asked you about, you know, lenders that, you know, you kind of joined the fray. But before we get to that, actually.
Yeah, sure.
The other side of the balance sheet, the funding, you know, because you have, you know, these adjustable rate loans. What does the funding look like? I know that's actually pretty simplistic as well.
Yeah, you know, we like adjustable rate on both sides of the balance sheet, really, you know, and we've avoided, I mean, we have obviously CD funding in our bank, you know, that is a medium duration, I'll call it, you know, 6 months, 1 year, some 2 years. But that is a small percentage of our overall deposit issue. Most of what we have is tied to the Fed effective rate, and or it's non-interest bearing, you know, due to customer, you know, operating accounts that sit with us. And, you know, so we really try to float on both sides. And, you know, thankfully for us, we have a lovely stable core deposit franchise. It was one of the jewels of the bank that, you know, I was very attracted to when Ross and I started talking about me joining the company, you know, three and a half years ago. Is I spent some time looking at the numbers, and, you know, the bank has 40 locations, about, you know, 30 of those are in rural markets, small towns. And, you know, as a result, those funds are very stable and they're very low cost. And so it's allowed us to enjoy margin expansion on the asset side of the balance sheet through the adjustable rate loans. So every time prime rate moves, you know, our interest income goes up. But it's also allowed our funding side of the balance sheet to lag a little bit. And so, you know, what I think has happened to us is the old fashioned model, you know, from when I cut my teeth back in, you know, 20 years ago when I started at the FDIC, you know, and watching Fed interest rate policy and the impact it had on banks, you know, as interest rates went up, you know, margins would expand. And then, you know, they would get shrunk, they would shrink up over time as, you know, funding costs kind of caught up with it. And so I think that's very similar to the curve that we're experiencing now. We've seen significant expansion in interest income, and our interest expense is climbing, but not at the same rate that the interest income is. And so that's allowed us to kind of, you know, enjoy a little, a little benefit here as we watch these rates change.
Well, the 4% ROE kind of speaks for itself. So another metric.
Yeah, and our margin too, I think we probably looked very much like our peers in the down part of the cycle. So during the pandemic, when interest rates were very low, we were living with a margin that was somewhere in the high threes, maybe low fours, depending on the day of the week. That margin has, while you look at our peers now, they're still living with high three margins, again, due to fixed rate portfolios and maybe more volatile funding. We've seen our margin expand to, I think in the last quarter, we reported just over 6 points, which is very high. And, I'm not, arguing that it's any particular genius on our part, except for just the way we designed the balance sheet has allowed us to harvest that kind of benefit, from this rate cycle. As I joke with our owner, I think he built the bank for 37 years for this year, so it's about time we got to enjoy the benefits of it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let me talk to you. Let me bring up talent, because that's Trevilian's bailiwick, as I always say. And I wanted to understand, because the methodology that you've just outlined for Interbank is very unique. And I know that you had mentioned that you executed a lift out of Dallas-Fort Worth. There was a community bank that was bought by Regional. And I'm thinking, that group of lenders comes to you and looks at you and hears about your credit culture. And, maybe it's a little bit of a, kind of what the heck, but they, do you have to teach your incoming employees and even your customers too, to kind of understand this pricing?
Yeah, so it's a transition for sure. And I think there may have been one or two skeptics, in the group that came over as to whether we could really pull this off and whether it would work. And there are consequences for our approach, and I think we have to be clear-eyed about that. We try to do things on purpose at our bank and not back into buzzsaws without intending to. But we did have a lot of conversations with our lenders, in the early going about our, preferences with respect to rate. And, I think their argument to us, which I think was a sound one, is that, it's going to preclude us from certain asset classes, stabilized commercial real estate being one of them, tends to gravitate to fixed rate. Office is another one that loves fixed rate because the leases tend to run longer. And so the borrower needs some certainty on their funding costs so that they understand through the cycle kind of what their cost structure is going to be. And so they can set, rents. And so, but we're not a big fan of office real estate anyway. And we do like volatility in our loan portfolio. Our senior lender says often in loan committee that volatility is a sign of a healthy bank. You want stuff to come in, stay a little while, and then go and free up the liquidity for you to put work on a new deal that is subject to fresh underwriting. And you can look at the economic conditions and kind of push the reset button a little faster. And so, what it's done is it's taken away some opportunities in the stabilized commercial real estate space, like retail and office, which aren't really focuses for us anyway. And it's opened up, tremendous opportunity in the construction business. Which gives us things that we like. One is it's more of an adjustable rate market. And two, these are deals that, our clients tend to be merchant builders. And so, we'll make an adjustable rate loan. We'll put a commitment on the books. It will fund up over 12 to 18 months, and then it'll stabilize over another 12 to 18 months. And then typically our borrowers will sell the property on the back end. And then we will, those funds will be freed up for us to underwrite something new and kind of push the reset button on that part of our bank. And so, and we try to, manage it sort of like a subway station. We have trains kind of coming in, and we try to set that up so that, we have a good flow of deals that are newly originated. Some of them are half funded up, some of them are fully funded and stabilized, and then, others are moving off the books. And so You know, I think it's not a rate policy that works for everybody, but I think, you know, you talked about talent, and I'll get back to that, but I think our lenders have really learned that once they understood our policy and kind of went to their relationships and said, this is what we do as a bank, and if you do this with us, you're going to get great customer service, and you're going to have somebody that is reliable and a dependable credit provider, you know, then I think, you know, they've been able to make it work. I think this new crew that we hired 3 years ago, I keep calling them the new crew, they're seasoned teammates of ours by this point, but you know, these folks have originated, you know, well in excess of $600-700 million in funded credit, and we've got another billion or so in unfunded commitments that are sitting out there, much of which was brought in by them. And so we feel like, and they feel like, I believe they would tell you that, you know, the experiment has been successful and that they found a way to thrive and make loans in our system. And I think certainly, you know, to the extent there were any skeptics, a lot of those folks have become believers, as have I, you know, as we've watched interest rates normalize and we've seen the impact it has on our income statement. And it's really sort of validated a lot of our long-held beliefs and, you know, helped us understand that, you know, this is a really sound and reasonable way to run the bank and to construct the balance sheet.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And it's, you know, I'm sure it stands out amongst your competitors. So I wanted to change the subject a little bit, CK. I would think that you coming in for Ross, you know, was some form of a succession planning, I would think, right?
Right.
And so as we're talking about talent, how have you and InterBank stayed ahead in the talent game and the succession planning game?
Yeah, so that's a good question. You know, one of the things that I think I've been most surprised by since I took this job is how much time I spend on personnel issues and how much time I've spent thinking about succession, you know, and my little corner of the world is just one part of our bank. And you're correct. I mean, I was brought in as part of, you know, Ross's succession planning as he's sort of thinking about some of the more senior folks on his team, you know, retiring. And as that happens, he wanted to make sure he had some folks, you know, as he says, in their 50s, you know, who are prepared to take over. And I wanted a good runway with those folks so that we could walk side by side and I could understand, you know, how we got here before, you know, my responsibilities really kicked up. And so, but, you know, it's not something I'm becoming convinced after 3 years of, you know, sort of thinking about it every day. I'm not convinced you ever get done succession planning. We have a succession plan that we develop on an annual basis and we refresh it as often as we need to, but it is an ongoing and continuous process. It's relentless. And I don't know that you can ever really stop thinking about it when you sit in my chair. And, you know, I think a particular benefit and attribute of our bank is all of our rural banks and small towns all across Texas and Oklahoma. But that's a challenge too, because, you know, we have to make sure we have succession in all of those locations. So you got to find motivated young people who have the capability to do the job and put them in these locations and give them the time to understand the customer base, to develop a rapport with the community, before we're asking them to take over, you know, responsibility. And in our system, the community bank president is a key role. You know, it is these people are responsible for everything from the air conditioning system on the roof to, you know, the carpet on the floor, the teller line, the operation side of the house, loan origination, and, you know, all the other things that come along with running a rooftop. And we don't have a level of middle management where, you know, you can call the facilities guy if you got a problem, or, you know, call this guy if you got another problem. You have to kind of manage all of that where you live. And so it takes a special, you know, talent to be able to do that in our bank and allow us to run as efficiently as we do. And so, you know, I've had to spend a lot of time thinking about our rural footprint and making sure that we have talented, smart young people sitting in the wings and getting the experience that they need so that, you know, when the folks ahead of them in line retire or move on to other things in their life, that we've got good backup there and, you know, the ability to take care of that. And, you know, we think about it a lot, just even on the operations side of the house. You know, I'm always having conversations with our operations leads about cross training and about succession planning and making sure that, you know, two people sitting side by side that may be doing different jobs, that they understand what the other one does, because, you know, we are not immune from the forces at play in the economy, where you just have a tremendous number of people who are seeing all kinds of opportunities to do something else. Many of them want to move somewhere. They want to leave and go to the lake. They, you know, and so as this happens, we just can't find ourselves captive to sort of key man syndrome or key person syndrome, where, you know, if some very important cog in our machinery decides to leave, we have to make sure that someone knows how to do her job or his job and can step in and fill the breach on a temporary basis, or that there's a number two there ready to promote up. And so we've just been really intentional about that. We talk about it all the time, and we talk about it with the people involved. You know, we explain to them that you are my succession plan for Northeastern Oklahoma, and I want to talk to you about, you know, how that works, and you need to get up there and start learning the business. And, you know, and I think it really, it helps, you know, some of our, you know, our younger folks understand kind of where they fit in our plans, and they're not left guessing. And it gives us the ability to evaluate them on the job and get them ready. And, but it's a, I used to think it was something that, you know, you did your succession plan and then you went and did something else. And yeah, I'm finding that it's really a full-time job.
Well, I love that you're cross-training. I mean, succession is really about skill set and competency, right? It's not about position. So I completely agree with you. And by the way, this is a little bit of a segue to our next subject. You used to be able to, you know, to use M&A to be part of your succession plan. From the top down, you'd be flush with talent that you're absorbing. But as we've seen, there haven't been a lot of M&A to talk about over the last year, 2 years. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe not be in the future in 2024 as well. So I wanted to talk about M&A. You can put your old IB hat on, and maybe we can talk more about the industry in general, and then also about InterBank and your strategy around, you know, M&A, if that even
feeds in. Yeah, so that's a good question, Brian. You know, we built, or I say we, I wasn't there, but Ross, when he built the bank over the last 35, 36 years, it really was built through acquisition. It started with an FDIC acquisition back in the 80s, and, you know, it just sort of expanded to the next town and the one after that. And, you know, it was a series of acquisitions that really put the bank together that forms the core of what we have today. But the last acquisition that we closed was probably 7 or 8 years ago. And so
you weren't even there yet.
There was, and there was a period of time where, you know, they were integrating charters and kind of moving from a multi-charter model to a single charter model, and, you know, really trying to get the back room in shape and get some, you know, as they moved across $3 billion, as you know, the regulatory scrutiny grows, and, you know, there was a ton of work put into risk management and credit and kind of building out, you know, what I'll call kind of, you know, top of class kind of organizational structure for the size of bank that we were. And so one of the tasks that I had when I came to the bank 3 years ago was to think about growth. You know, what do we do? And I really think, and Ross really thought, I think, you know, is that we were going to grow by M&A, because it was what I'd been doing. I have a ton of bank relationships, you know, around Texas and Oklahoma, and so does he. And we figured, you know, between the two of us, we had a lot of capital sitting around, you know, from the pandemic and, you know, from the bank having sort of sat still and just accumulated capital for a few years. It was really in a position to do whatever it wanted. And I think our working hypothesis was we would go find banks to buy. But as it turned out, within a month or two of my joining the bank, you know, we were presented with an opportunity to onboard, you know, a group of really talented producers in the DFW Metroplex. You know, and as we studied that opportunity, we sort of came to the conclusion that that was not only a safe way for us to grow the bank, but it was growing the bank in a fiscally responsible way in a key market that we were in. So we were in Dallas and we were in Fort Worth, and we had a Metroplex branch presence, But we just needed the lending horsepower to go with that and to lean into that market a little bit. And it, you know, it really was a once in a lifetime opportunity. And so, you know, getting those folks on board and, you know, getting them in our system was, you know, just a really important part of executing on a growth strategy. And you know, it's worked really well. And so now we kind of scratch our heads and say, does it make sense to really go buy banks? And what could we buy that would really add value to us? I mean, most of the rationale for M&A is to add scale and to add efficiency, right? To grow if you're not big enough, to get relevant and to get more efficient across, you know, the platform. And, you know, we feel like we're big enough to be relevant in all the markets we care to play in. And, you know, Lord knows we're plenty efficient. So I don't know that we need to capture that. But, you know, to your point, it's deprived us of a regular inflow of talent that would come through that, you know. And I do think, you know, as I look around our bank, all of our key leaders came to us through acquisition. You know, they came to us because, and you know, it's interesting. I was in Western Oklahoma the other day and I was talking to a lady and she said, yeah, I said, how long have you been with us? And she said, well, I've been with Interbank since 1998 or 2000 or whenever, you know, the bank bought her bank. But she said, I've been sitting at this desk for 40 years and I've been through four different banks, you know, and and she hasn't moved. And you know, you go around our bank and you talk to people and many, many of them, you know, came to us through acquisitions. And so, you know, it's really forced us to spend a lot more time on external, you know, hiring and bringing in talent from outside because we've kind of closed off that hose pipe that was bringing folks into the bank that we could depend on to help us lead different functions. And so, you know, that has been an interesting challenge, but we feel like, you know, the organic growth strategy is one that, you know, is not only financially sound, but, you know, has really served us well here over the last few years. And our inclination is to kind of stick with that until something better comes along.
Yeah. And one thing you said to me in a prior discussion about M&A, CK, you said that the management distraction issue, how it feels so daunting and disruptive to do M&A because you're taking these people away from what they do on a day-to-day and like making them integrate other things. It's worth it, maybe over the long run, but I know that's actually an interesting perspective of M&A. So maybe these are the good times where you're not doing it, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm probably being a little selfish when I talk about that. You know, we are seeing a ton of loan demand and they're not small deals. And so getting our pipeline pushed through, underwritten, properly evaluated, closed, and properly administered, it's a full-time job for a lot of us. And, you know, we spend a lot of time on that. And I just keep wondering, you know, where are the hours in the day that I would spend if we were buying a bank every 6 months? And, you know, it would have to be a line of business that we would have to staff that would require a ton of my attention and my colleagues' attention at the bank. And, you know, again, I just keep coming back to, you know, okay, so where's the corresponding value? What does it get us that we don't already have now? You know, the one possibility that I could see in M&A bringing value is, you know, liquidity and deposits. And so, you know, if we've got a strong loan engine, obviously we're going to have to fund it. And, you know, it may be more cost effective to fund it through bank acquisitions than through, you know, doing it the old fashioned way, kind of one depositor at a time. But when you think about who the deposit rich banks are, and we've done a little analysis on this point, you know, all the banks that have tons of liquidity that would be attractive to us also have tons of what? Bonds. So they're all sitting with significant embedded losses in their bond portfolio that would really prohibit them or us from wanting to step in, you know, sort of somebody's got to take that loss and realize it forever. And, you know, if I was them sitting on their side of the table, I would probably want to just ride the bond cycle out and collect the bonds at par and not take those losses. You know, so that's really going to forestall a lot of that M&A that would be attractive to us for a few years while these banks kind of work out of their positions on the investment side. So, you know, it's all kind of adding up to you know, we see deals come along from time to time that, you know, we kick the tires on, but it's, you know, as of now, it just doesn't look like there's a ton that's going to come our way that, you know, would make sense, but you never say never. We're an opportunistic organization, and the right deal lands in our lap, you know, we'll jump on it and, you know, we'll find the time to do it.
And then I guess two last questions. I mean, what's your take on M&A in the industry, more on like a macro level? Where do you see it going in an election year and beyond?
Well, you know, and I haven't really thought this through, so I'll just venture a hypothesis. I think you're going to see a similar cycle to what you saw after the last crisis. You know, we kind of had no M&A for a while where everybody was shell-shocked and, oh my gosh, what's happening? And we have to triage our bank and we have to make sure we don't make any problem we have worse. You know, currency's depressed, that, you know, all of that kind of leads to a stoppage. And that's understandable. It's not only financial rules of the universe, but it's also, you know, human nature. Then you see, you know, the first emergence of what I'll call lifeboat M&A, you know, two organizations, you know, struggling, maybe they merge, you know, maybe good organization buys bad organization for a song and a dance. And, you know, the opportunistic guys come out of the woodwork and, you know, do some lifeboat work, you know, getting people in the lifeboat. And then, you know, following a period of time, you sort of see the emergence of a normalized M&A market. And I think that's going to flow from a normalized capital market. So, you know, as bank stocks recover, and I think, you know, banking fundamentals by and large across the industry are pretty strong. You know, I think as it's just, you know, banks have a time series problem. You know, they either have to time out of their fixed rate portfolio and allow that to reprice for the world as it sits today, or they have to wait out their bond portfolio, you know, and allow those losses that they're sitting, you know, that are kind of paper losses now, you know, to see those kind of those gaps close. And so, you know, I think as time, as we solve for the time problem, I think you'll see a normalized M&A market emerge, and it'll probably come back with a bang, because I do think a lot of these, you know, smaller organizations, you know, probably think, you know, they're living through their last downturn and they don't want to do another one. So if they get an opportunity to sell their bank at a decent premium, I'm sure you'll see a lot of them sell it. But, you know, we've had some transactions here in the last month that have been interesting. And I would, you know, maybe fairly or unfairly from what I read in the papers, you know, kind of characterizing that lifeboat sort of thing where, you know, you got a couple of banks in California that merged, both of whom had some, you know, some issues. And, but I think, you know, they're betting that together, you know, they can be complementary to each other and kind of come out with stronger balance sheet and a better ability to withstand what's going on. So, you know, I think we'll see some of that. And, you know, to talk with some of the guys that I talk to from my old industry, you know, tell me that, you know, they're looking at a decent 24, that the conversations are still ongoing. Everybody's just kind of waiting for the math to work. You know, and so I think we could see a nice resurgence.
Yeah, it's like someone just needs to get in the water, like that scene from Jaws where the mayor says, "Could you get in the water, please?" You know, and then everyone gets in, right?
Yeah.
So my last question, I just mentioned Jaws. I'm kind of curious, what is your favorite movie, CK?
I've always loved Midnight Run.
With De Niro.
It's an old De Niro movie. It's a fantastic rollicking road story of a couple of misfits running across America on planes, trains, and automobiles. And in an homage to my love for flying, it has a very short scene on an Indian reservation that involves a Boeing Stearman biplane trainer, which I also happen to fly. So anything that's got adventure and crazy car chases and a Stearman, I'm pretty much a sucker for it.
Wow, there's the trifecta. I thought you were going to mention the scene where Charles Grodin gets kicked out of first class, doesn't he? Then they kick him off the flight.
That's right. Yeah, you know, and my kids have really, we've all enjoyed, I think we've watched it twice or three times now. The most recent Top Gun movie has been popular in our household. And I like it for the airplanes. My kids may or may not like it for Tom Cruise. I don't know, you know, or some of the other young fellas playing football, but I have two daughters, so I won't tell you why they like it, but I like it for the airplanes. It's good fun.
Yeah, it was an exciting film. Well, I appreciate you taking one off script here. I'm a movie buff, so now I know that CK loves the airplanes and action flicks. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate you giving us a perspective of not only your own career, but your role at Interbank, as well as Interbank's, you know, place in the space. And I wish you and your team continued success.
Well, you bet, Brian, and we're happy to help. And it's great catching up with you, and you guys do good work, and we appreciate you.
Sounds good. Well, thank you, CK.
All right. Take care.